If you're hearing this, it means tickets are now on sale for our streaming Cybactacular.
That's what we're calling the streaming show of our Star Trek V review that we toured last year. We filmed our Hollywood show, and it's going to be streaming on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And the stream will be available for a couple of weeks after that. If you can't watch right at the premiere time. A couple of pieces of information about this. If you support us at MaximumFun.org/join and your membership is current, check your email inbox because Maximum Fun will have emailed you a promo code to get $5 off your ticket. And also, we have some VIP packages available that include a meet and greet with me and Adam. Those are going fast, so jump on that if you want a meet and greet VIP package. Again, it's greatestgentour.com to get your tickets for the streaming Cybactacular.
Captain!
Not here.
Captain!
Report.
Signatures detected.
Shields up.
Signatures detected.
Red alert.
Context Starfleet Command.
What's happening?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair. Chair.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons? Those are Klingons?
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery. It's a new Star Trek podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison.
Yeah, you are.
Resolving to watch more Star Trek this year.
That's your resolution?
Yeah.
I think my resolution, were I to have one, I'm strongly anti-resolution.
Yeah, you've made
long,
this.
Long-time listeners of the show will know that.
You've made this. I mean, I'm sort of cast resolution, sort of indifferent to them.
Yeah.
If I make one, I'm not like super down on myself if I don't keep it up, but you know, I'm also like not making one every single year.
I just hope we have a better year in no specific way whatsoever.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we can do it too.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to maintain optimism sometimes, but I think, you know, last year had so many different kinds of kicks in the junk.
It was like a four-dimensional ball-kicking machine.
But, you know, lightning never strikes the same place twice, and I feel like those balls have already been kicked.
So. Yeah, our balls have been struck by lightning so often.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting having Star Trek run through the holidays like this. Doesn't it feel kind of unusual?
Do you remember growing up watching it during the holidays when it was first run Star Trek The Next Generation? I can't remember it going that way.
Yeah, I can't either. I mean, it must have run a little bit close to the holidays because they were making 26 episodes a season. Like,
yeah,
literally half of all weeks in the year got a new episode of Star Trek. That's bonkers. They were really killing themselves.
You imagine working that hard year in and year out with no breaks?
Yes. You sometimes hear like Michael Okuda or somebody like that in an interview going like, yeah, like we would work these crazy long days, but it didn't matter to us because we were having so much fun.
Because Coke in the late 80s and early 90s was like your dad's weed. Extremely chill.
And plentiful at the craft services table. It was a performance-enhancing drug, man. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, now that we have our new producer, hoping that our work lives go to a little bit more of a manageable pace.
Yeah. I mean, when the show is really cracking, and I'm thinking of the one or two really good shows we've ever done, it's because
that one episode where we said fuck Bokai being maybe the only noteworthy good episode.
It's because we've brought an outside experience to it, and the Lucy's footballification of modern life, where like the promise of going out and doing things only to be taken away is the vibe. And I hope to be bringing the vibe of new experiences to future shows.
Like a stand-up comic, you want to go back out on some premise walks.
Yes, I really do.
That'd be nice.
Those days are coming, man.
They're coming.
Those days have no choice but to come. Maybe even come earlier than you want them to.
Get those days out of that tax documents folder.
Yeah. Sometimes you want to spend your days before going out and spending meaningful days. Mm-hmm. You catch my drift.
Right. Yeah.
You don't want to go out there with a loaded day.
Yeah, you want to clear the pipes, clear your head.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not trying to be having a head normative like Gray was to Zora.
Yeah,
geez. That was fucked up.
Hey, anytime now, Star Trek Discovery, I would like to know how, and I'm just going to like make the gesture with my hand, the Gollum works. Like, like, is that a screw top head we're dealing with there? Like, at least with Data, Star Trek The Next Generation was so good at popping the hood on Data. Like, open up the little neck flap, open up the little hair flap, take an arm off every once in a while.
Take his arm off in a court of law.
You never forget that Data is Data. And I think there's Gollum erasure happening in Star Trek Discovery, and I don't like it.
Well, there's going to be more than Gollum erasure. It seems like Gray got written off the show this episode, Adam. Do you want to get into it?
Yeah, we've got so much to talk about here on Star Trek Discovery Season 4, Episode 7. But to connect? Got some ellipses in the title here, Ben.
Yeah. I don't know how to pronounce ellipses. We get a nice close up as the dots are repairing the disco. No word yet on whether it's going to be the A still or if it's going to get upgrade again to B. I mean, it seems like multiple times so far this season already they've been low on power when they really needed it.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like they might want to go to B and add another warp core or something.
Agreed. Yeah.
Or a protostar. We know that's possible now.
The repairs continue apace. Repairs that look analogous to like skin grafts for a hull. These are like hull grafts, basically, going on to the skeleton of the ship. The damage looks significant enough to where like ordinarily a Starfleet would just total the ship. But in this case, Discovery is going to have a salvage title.
Yeah.
And you know, that means just like a loss of value when it comes time to sell the Discovery. It's a real bad situation.
When you pull the Starfax. For ooh, this really went through something.
The Starfax dot mascot there to tell you to check the odometer.
Right.
When you're a time ship, does your odometer even matter?
Oh yeah. It's like
probably doesn't.
Ferris Bueller running the thing backward out the window.
You're probably cool with the salvage title if it comes with the spore drive, right?
Yeah, right.
You can look past a salvage title.
They don't make them like that anymore.
I bought a salvage title car before. Big mistake. Big mistake.
Wow. No kidding.
Yeah.
That must be why they tell you not to do that.
That's why banks won't loan money for salvage title cars. And there it sits.
In engineering, Adira and Stamets are working on coordinates for possible places where the anomaly, the DMA, entered the galaxy. And I guess these are just like places where there's like low density of those particles that we talked about in the last episode that could be like a hole that was punched by the DMA when it came into the Milky Way.
Yeah.
But there are lots and lots of points on their map of potential options, which means that they've got a veritable needle to look for in this haystack before they find the 10C.
It's frustrating because the expectation of a supercomputer that is 800 years in the future of the previous supercomputer, which was hundreds of years ahead of today, can't do any better than 147 possible conclusions to this question. It's infuriating.
She can do this. Just give her a little bit of time.
It's already been a week.
And also confusing because I don't know about you, but I watched this scene a couple times and I felt like the logic of the scene broke for me. Where like it was like Adira saying give Zora more time on the one hand, and then Stamets saying no, give Zora more time on the other hand, and then one of them saying, but the assembly's coming up. Well, can we get a delay on the assembly? No, we need to give Zora more time. It's been weeks already, but Zora is going to finish it in moments.
Well, Ben, if you love an argument about what we should do about Zora, this is your episode.
It really is. I mean, like, I was less confused by the rest of this episode. This one scene, I feel like it just didn't quite, like, make sense to me who was advocating for what. And And it's all kind of like taken off the table because Zora's like, okay, I got the answer. I'm going to have the answer like 5 minutes from now.
We can't linger in this moment too long, Ben, because we had a meeting to get to. There's a big ass meeting with reps from all four quadrants.
It's like a super McLaughlin group.
Issue one.
It's one of those ones where you're fortunate enough to get Pat Buchanan and Eleanor Clift on the same show.
Wow.
Sometimes they have to be separated.
He identifies with Assad. He identifies with.
Sometimes their talk is just too hard.
Speaking of people that should probably be separated, Michael Burnham is trying to make friends with Book's cat.
You mean I've earned her utter indifference?
She's really making an effort in a way that I feel like you probably never did with your late cat.
Oh, shut the fuck up. I most certainly did make an effort. This is why I personally hold such a grudge against all cats everywhere. Michael Burnham doesn't realize that because Grudge is a cat, she does not care about her or anyone.
Yeah. In your defense, I'm a person that cats traditionally really like. I've been a friend to the feline, and that was a particularly hard cat to make friends with.
What is it about you that makes cats like you?
Because I know the ways of the cat. I know what not to do.
You don't know anything.
I know.
you can't be specific.
Your cat liked me more than it liked you. So
I know. Most people feel that way about us if given a choice.
I mean, a lot of this is instinct, so it's hard to like put into words. But I guess it's like how you pet a cat, how you introduce yourself to a cat. You know, like letting the cat sniff the back of your hand first and get a sense of you. And then, you know, knowing the signs that a cat is like kind of done with the interaction.
Yeah.
Early before the cat kind of turns into a bladed weapon.
See, my problem is I treat all cats like dogs and I shouldn't be doing that.
This is the same problem my wife struggles with. She's cat curious, but she's never had like positive interactions with them because she grew up in a dog house.
Yeah, dog houses are cool as hell. Cat houses smell like fucking cat boxes.
She uses this cat toy as a metaphor. You know, this is a topsy-turvy, crazy galaxy, Adam. So much fucking shit is going on. Michael Burnham trying to focus on controlling the cat toy, not the cat.
I wonder why they don't show us the exterior of Book's ship inside the cargo bay very often, like a little bit wider. They show us to establish location.
Yeah.
But if what they really want to do is emphasize the tone of the separateness in how Book is feeling, which I believe is the intent every time we cut over to Book's ship and that's where he is instead of Discovery.
Right.
Why not give us that in visual language a little clearer? Like he is alone in his own ship inside a bigger ship. And I think there's something more profound about a composition like that than the kind that we usually get.
Yeah. I also feel like there is maybe a little bit of a, like, if I am consciously thinking, okay, where are we? Oh, we're on Book's ship. I will be able to identify that it's Book's ship, but the lighting and the color palette of Book's ship are so similar to the rest of Disco. Where, like, the Federation headquarters, you'd never think you're on the Discovery when you're in the Federation headquarters because the lighting is so different, the color palette is so different.
Right.
And I wish Book's ship felt really distinct in that way.
Yeah.
You know, he's grieving. Michael Burnham, of course, still really broken over losing that dot in the last episode. Doesn't bring up Cortez, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, Cortez only died a painful death in front of Dr. Pollard. Mm-hmm. It was the dot that was tortured and murdered in front of the assembled bridge crew.
In front of everybody, yeah. Yeah, that was their shared grief.
I'm going to take a walk.
Playing with the cat gets interrupted because there's news, breaking news.
Mm-hmm.
Zora has found the location of the beings who made the DMA.
Yeah.
It's very exciting.
We've got coordinates, people. Michael Burnham and Book go down to engineering where Stamets and Ajira are like, good news, bad news. And they start talking to Zora, and Zora says, I am worried that if I tell you where the bad guys are, you will want to go to there. And that would be really dangerous. So I'm just not even going to tell you. And Michael Burnham tries ordering Zora.
Give us the coordinates. That's an order.
You didn't say the magic word.
But Zora's not in the chain of command. Zora can do whatever the fuck Zora wants.
This is such a nightmare.
This is exactly what you were worried about last episode, Adam.
Should this have been so transparent? I feel upset by this because the fact of it is upsetting, but also because it was so predictable.
I have to say, I admire your ability to predict it because it did not... I'm a naive moron, so I didn't...
It's why cats love you.
I didn't... Yeah, exactly. I didn't pick up on it last episode, but you fucking nailed it. I guess whatever Zora wants, Zora gets.
So that's where we are.
Yeah.
A rogue supercomputer with 100,000 years of information that just makes its own decisions. That's where we're at. Because what we need is a second huge problem to solve in this season.
We don't.
There are a lot of intense eyes to theme song upon the revelation of this information.
Who are you going to call with a problem like this, Ben? It's Dr. Kovach, obviously.
Yeah. Computer busters.
And in a scene that had me screaming internally at the screen, how could you have this conversation on Discovery?
Yeah.
How could you possibly do this?
Because Kovach
is insane.
Sitting very calm in the ready room with Saru saying like, yeah, I brought a crowbar. And, you know, if this turns out to be a problem, I can just wrench Zora out of the computer.
And Kovach has been empowered by Admiral Blackjack Dealer in a cruise ship casino to kind of take over the problem of Zora, thus reassigning Michael Burnham to President Rilik's conference as a task.
Michael Burnham is back on politics duty with President Rilik in this episode. So
when Burnham leaves this meeting, Ben, are we supposed to side with her or Kovach? Because I'll tell you whose side I was on. Fucking Kovach, 1,000%. Because nothing about Burnham's behavior up until now makes her a trustworthy person to make a decision with respect to Zora in any way.
Yeah.
She let this slip past the goalie.
She did, but she also saw what Zora did with that freedom, right? Like, she and the crew survived the exiting the rift because...
You shouldn't have to ask your computer to pretty please beam us out of the transport buffer once the ship survives. If you could get around to it, possibly, please and thank you. Fuck that shit. Any other computer, you could be like, it's like setting a timer on your Apple Watch. Hey, when we're out of the rift, beam us out of the buffer.
Yeah.
It just works the way it ought to.
Well, I mean, being in the chain of command would help that situation a lot because... Yeah. Then it would be Michael Burnham's call, right?
We shouldn't fix the problem. We should add complexity to the problem. Does it sound like I'm mad at this episode? I feel like I'm getting mad at this episode.
It's interesting because I've read a bunch of the Culture series of sci-fi novels where the ships are sentient beings that like love everybody that lives on board them and are in charge of what the ships do, and that's just
fine. I have no point of reference the way you have, though. I do not consume science fiction with living ships.
Yeah, and like, I wonder if that's, like, informing my, like, acceptance of this as an idea.
Maybe.
Maybe I come pre-open to this in a way that you don't.
I mean, it's another reason why cats love you.
Right. I think I have a cool collection of sci-fi novels.
We're coming up with a great list here.
I know. All the more reason to be at the assembly and help make a plan so when we do get the coordinates, we'll be ready.
At the assembly, it is a fun mix of loafs here.
I love seeing all these loafs. This is like, you know, diplomatic meetings in Star Trek IV level of different kinds of loaf.
Michael Burnham spots Ndoye, who you might remember as the Federation Earth Defense Force.
Yeah.
Person who gave her and the Discovery the warm welcome they received when they went back to Earth.
Yeah.
Right after time traveling. And she is now the general of United Earth, which now includes Titan.
Yeah. They made friends with Titan after Michael Burnham set such a good example for them. But they are still not in the Federation and are still sort of chilly on that idea.
She straight up smashes Rilik's balls before leaving this conversation here. To that effect.
Yeah. And Michael Burnham's like, why do you give a shit? You're half Cardassian, half Bajoran, right? And Rilik is like, actually, I'm half human. What?
You mean you can be more than just two things?
What the fuck?
She goes back to consult her crystalline entity tree.
Yeah.
She's like, oh yeah, like that would be how the branching works and so forth.
Yeah.
You're above your dad? What the hell?
Kind of a sad fact that Earth isn't part of the Federation.
Yeah.
Like, I kind of like that.
Yeah.
About this reality.
And Doye, I saw her off talking to Trina. Maybe trying to move in on Saru's territory.
I don't like that at all.
Get the fuck off of Trina's jock. That's Saru's girl.
You better nip that in the bud. So the assembly begins in a room that is not great for acoustics, Ben. It is basically a warp core on top of a warp core on top of a warp core. And then like
tallest, skinniest assembly hall ever.
Kind of an airport parking garage ramp situation that encircles it.
Yeah. It's what's that museum called?
You're asking me about a museum? I'll just let you figure this one out. The Louvre?
It's like the Guggenheim, but for diplomacy, not art.
Is it like the Guggenheim?
Yeah, it's just like that. That's what I was thinking of. We also get Tarka there. He comes up acting somewhat chummy with Book.
Yeah. Book's like, I'm not your buddy, guy.
And yeah, Book is real standoffish with him. And I was like, where are you coming from with that energy, Book? Like,
Mr. Booker, it's been a while.
You say it like we're friends.
You had a pretty good interaction with Tarka the last time you talked. Like, do you really need to fucking stomp his junk just for being like friendly when he comes up and says hi to you?
I might have been secretly convinced to dislike Book from the last few episodes. Like, is that what the show is trying to do? Turn him into a jerk?
Plant seeds that Book is the bad?
Yeah, because I'm not really riding for his decision-making up until now. And then, like, with the way he treats Tarka, not great. But Tarka's there for a means-to-an-end angle.
Yeah.
And Book is there because maybe he'll get a mission with Burnham out of it. Like, no one knows why Book is there.
I mean, I think he's there to stand for the planet that got destroyed.
Hey, all meeting attendees, just want to be clear that you're here because you're from a planet. Book, you can leave, I guess, at any time.
Please wait in the hallway, Book.
This is sort of a planet coming from only club.
Yeah, yeah. Tarka's talking about politicians here, I think, is worth noting. Something that I think that maybe is like a bigger problem than we really think about it in our modern era is that people think that politicians are there to like lead and do things for them. And Tarka really thinks of politicians as people to use to his own designs. And I think that that is a much better way of thinking about politics. Like if your politician did something you didn't like, engage with them, get active and pull them toward, like, I don't necessarily agree with Tarka's politics, but I agree with the way he goes about doing them.
And you'll defend to the death his right to do it.
Right, exactly. So they get this meeting started, and Rilik is saying, like, we're here from all four quadrants.
She uses that kind of gesticulation to, like, point to the quadrants, like, in the room.
If you don't see your quadrant, it might be behind you. This is people from all across the galaxy. Some people have had to zoom in because of the great distance and due to the pandemic.
In a room like this, I think you got to feel a lot of pressure to just stop any jumpers before they happen.
The scope of the peril that threatens us is unprecedented.
Especially when you drop the news about the DMA. Like, like, let that hang and then wait for the jump.
The big question, are we going to, once we get the coordinates, which, you know, we're sure we're going to get them at any minute. Once we get the coordinates of whoever sent it, are we going to attack them or are we going to try to open up some sort of diplomatic overture and ask them why they're doing this?
Hit X to attack them.
Yeah.
Hit box to have conversation.
I thought that Trina's point here was pretty interesting. Like, the DMA is very destructive, but given how randomly it seems to be doing that destruction, it doesn't seem super weapony. mm-hmm. so much as just maybe a blunt instrument that is trying to do something else.
Right.
But hard to say. Like from book standpoint, it's the weaponiest thing that has ever weaponed.
It's like having diarrhea in a hot tub. Like, you need to get rid of the diarrhea. You don't just kill the person who took a shit in your hot tub. It's exactly like that.
If it was my hot tub and somebody shit in it.
Yeah, I think murder's on the table.
Yeah, I think me and Targa and Book might agree on the solution to that problem.
Really big day here for the 60 member worlds. They're voting today on this.
Yeah.
Vote to bomb or not bomb.
A lot of people speak. You know, Michael Burnham speaks, Book speaks, the Mothman speaks.
Yeah. I don't have a really strong opinion on whether or not we bomb or pursue diplomacy. I'm just here to say that, like, the lights in this room are extremely bright and attractive to me, and it just makes me want to walk right in to these lights every time I see one.
Does anybody have a sweater I could munch on? I am pretty hungry.
I was told there would be snacks.
In the ready room, Saru talking to Kovic about how he thinks that Zora is well-meaning, but maybe a little bit naive or new to this whole having a mind thing. And Kovic says, like, hey, listen, like, everybody is a good guy in their own mind. I'm here to find out if Zora is or is not a good guy. And then Adam walks in and goes, I cannot believe you guys are having this conversation in front of Zora.
This is an argument that is supported by Stamets and Culber, though.
UM becomes Stamets.
Yeah. Stamets and Culber walk in with a boombox playing loud music, wanting to huddle up physically with the other people in this room, which is, and I don't put this lightly, the stupidest idea from a smart character we've seen in a very long time.
Commander Stamets, are you feeling all right?
Yeah, I guess we don't really know how much audio acuity Zora has.
No, but I'm guessing at least how levels of lip reading could happen here, right?
Yeah, not to be outdone in the stupid idea department, though. Kovic is like, turn off the music. We can just talk about this openly.
Yeah, Stamets reveals himself to be an anti-Zora because of, you know, control.
He's worried about it contrelanding him.
And Saru and Culber are like, hey, Zora is a job creator that would never hurt us.
Your analogy is that Zora is a billionaire?
Yeah, that is it exactly. Yeah. Yeah, we should coddle Zora. Make Zora feel like a hero in their own mind. Mm. Kovic cuts through the bullshit, though. He's like, look, I'm the authority here, and it's totally in my power to take Zora out of Discovery and put that combination of sphere data and sentience into another host, .. of their choosing.
Yeah, something like Gray, maybe another golem.
And because this is a show that has been written, Adira and Gray walk in right on cue to advocate for this idea utterly.
Sir, we want to speak on her behalf.
Thank you both, but it's going to be all right.
Well, yeah, and Starfleet systems are, we're told, not allowed to have sentient AI installed in them. So part of what Kovic is here to decide is, like, is this a sentient AI? And if so, does it violate that rule? And yeah, Lawyer Gray and Lawyer Adira are here to serve as Zora's advocates.
Because Adira, an ensign, and Gray, a non-crew person, are allowed to just enter whatever part of the ship they want to at any time to make the case for whatever they want to make the case for.
Yeah. I thought that it was too bad that more wasn't made out of the conflict between Adira and Gray and Stamets in this, because, like, they have made so much of a case of them being family, and them being so at odds on this issue felt like it should have had interpersonal implications.
That is a valence to the conflict. Absolutely. That's just totally unexplored. Yeah.
I wish they'd totally talked about that a little bit.
Yeah. Zora takes this moment to offer up a compromise. I'll give you a button
Yeah.
It looks like a butter warmer gift on a wire cutter list to kill me with.
Yeah. It's a, the second you're worried about is Zora acting in everybody's best interest, you can just punch this button and the sentience will go away and it will go back to being Disco plus sphere data minus consciousness.
Nothing speaks to a person's sanity better than the presentation of a weapon to kill them with and a request to do that at any point you see fit.
Yeah. Were you a little distracted by how similar this device wound up looking to the thing that Tarka presents in hologram to the assembly?
I did not get its similarity in that way, no.
They're both kind of like faceted, like round objects that, I don't know, like they're not identical, but like Tarka at the assembly is like, I alone can save you from the DMA. And here is how. When I was on the Discovery that last time, I got enough data to come up with this weapon. It's a weapon that will destroy the device at the heart of the DMA, and it's really the only option. So go ahead and vote for me. All right, peace. Tarka out.
He's a real showman, isn't he? I got like Carnival Barker vibes from him in this moment. Like he's very persuasive in my mind.
I would have been like, cool, episode over, except the music is so ominous.
My proposal carries some risk, but not nearly as much as doing nothing.
Part of what really sells me on the idea is how fast the plan goes. He's like, look, man, we just spore jump in, drop the bomb, spore jump out, wham, bam, thank you, DMA.
Thank you, Tarka.
And it's over. And everyone, like, based on music cue, is horrified because this weapon is isolytic.
Yeah.
And that is something that they're not allowed to have as a weapon because when you set off isolytic weapons, it has all sorts of bad consequences, like preventing warp travel in that area.
This is kind of an interesting argument.
And it's kind of one of those things like a cherry bomb, right? Like if you set off an isolytic weapon and it collapses the DMA, that weapon also explodes on the other side of the wormhole that it came from. And so it kind of sends a powerful message about your feelings regarding the DMA to its creator, a message you might not want to be sending.
The Tensi would feel this, and we might be inviting the Tensi to...
it's the scientific equivalent of Randy Marsh taking his shirt off.
What do you want to do, huh?
Yeah, I mean, like if the DMA is a blunt instrument that is accidentally weapon, not intentionally weapon, it seems like whatever they have that's intentionally weapon would be scary as fuck.
Yeah, it's too bad that Tarka couldn't make an isolytic weapon that may or may not be a weapon that just goes about its business and may or may not explode next to the DMA. Then it's the same.
And then the Tensi would certainly understand, hey, this was just what happened. You know, I was walking across the room swinging my arms wildly. The fact that I punched you in the face is not my fault. It was just that's where your face happened to be.
I think we've made a lot of the melodramatic nature of a Michael Burnham speechification moment, but I found this scene really good for her. Burnham's position is that a bomb only sends one message, but First Contact makes it possible to send a bunch of different ones with some nuance.
And
she is as persuasive as Tarka is.
And the fact that she would be the one, you know, it, like Disco becomes the Enola Gay in Tarka's scenario. So
yeah,
she feels like she has a vested interest in this being actually the best idea before they go do it.
She's also invested in the idea of diplomacy because she knows she'll be the diplomat involved.
It's a lot of dirty looks from Book over the course of these scenes.
Relic's like, cool, all right, so now that we know what we're voting on, let's have a brief recess.
If anybody needs to like confer with their buddies or whatever,
we'll get some of these hungry aliens some lunch.
And we'll get that guy a sweater.
Yeah.
Pretty similar conversation is being had in Parallel Pack on the Disco, where Gray is saying like, hey, this kill switch thing is a really bad deal for Zora and just for precedent in general. Like if weird one-off consciousnesses were things that we were just in the habit of being able to kill at the press of a button, neither Adira nor I would be here. And that kind of pulls Culber over onto their side, which was another moment where I wanted Stamets to be like, what the fuck? I can't believe my family is betraying me or whatever, you know?
It isn't the same thing.
Did it irritate you that you didn't know how the kill switch worked?
I mean, it looked like an egg timer to me, so.
If you push the button, two things will happen.
Right, but I wanted to know exactly.
Yeah.
Like, is it just a fucking easy button that you get from a Staples?
Right.
Or is it something with a couple of switches, like, that you turn keys on at the same time?
Right, yeah, you need two people.
Like, how dangerous is it to even have in the room for fear of accidental termination, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, right. Somebody is, like, gesticulating and accidentally bumps it.
Like, cool, Zora made a kill switch, but the kill switch is so hard to operate that, like, no one in the room even knows
you
how.
You have to solve a five-sided Rubik's Cube? What the fuck? Come on, Zora.
I'm with you, Ben. I think a greater amount of conflict between Gray, Adira, and Stamets and Culber would help obscure the real problem I had with an ensign's opinion mattering in a context like this. Like, yeah. I still maintain Adira and Gray are there because we wrote them there as a show, instead of there being a real reason for them to be there and for their opinion to matter at all in this context. Like, could you imagine being the bridge crew outside, seeing Gray and Adira walk into this meeting?
Marching.
With their ability to have their voices heard. The show's all about being seen and heard. Guess who isn't being seen and heard?
Yeah.
Every other bridge crew person.
Reese just, like, pulls a fucking phaser out and sticks it in his mouth.
That weird alien with, like, the giant trilobite head.
Yeah.
Like, sticks a phaser in a hole. Like, oh, I wouldn't have expected that to be the mouth, but
yeah,
there it is.
After I was separated from Squidira, everybody listens to to Adira, and nobody listens to Squid.
Doesn't anyone see that this is wrong?
You know what? There's no one for Squid to exchange grief currency with.
At the end of this scene, they ask Zora about her primary function, and it is to...
Can you out, you know, work the streets for me?
That's not the core programming of a ship's computer.
I'm 1,000% on pull the plug on Zora here at this moment in the episode.
Book and Michael Burnham have found themselves in one of those relationships where one person is a liberal Democrat and the other person is a conservative Republican.
But I don't think Book gets a vote here, does he?
I don't know.
This goes back to the question of whether or not his world or lack of world gives him voting rights in this context.
But he has an opinion about which...
This is what's so confusing about a hands up or don't raise your hand vote.
Yeah.
Because you can't tell by Book keeping his hand down if he gets to vote at all.
Well, yeah. And it's also very having hands normative in a way.
It really is. I thought that was a disgusting display by Rilik there.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, there are squid aliens, right?
Yeah.
What are the Ba'ul supposed to do? Hold up their gooey limb?
Yeah, and how many tentacles equals a hand?
Yeah. Fucked up.
I think we need to impeach President Rilik.
If she could only hear herself. Raise your hand.
Why, the very name is racist.
Yeah. Burnham asks Rilik what side of the argument she would prefer, and Rilik's like, don't ask me, I'm the judge.
Yeah. Rilik is has recused herself from voting because it was so hard for her just to, like, convince everybody to show up.
Imagine a president without an opinion on legislation. What the fuck is this? What would you say you do here, President Rilik?
Also, why is Admiral Bottle Service not the one here casting the vote? Why does that fall to Michael Burnham?
I do not get it.
Other than that Rilik, like, kind of relies on Michael Burnham in these political moments.
Does Burnham not realize she's being kind of used by Rilik?
I mean, yeah, like kind of the inverse of what Tarka was talking about, Rilik using Michael Burnham the way Tarka's talking about using the politicians.
Yeah.
And she's like, yeah, if you feel like you're up to it or whatever, you could make an argument for the diplomacy angle, but I don't really have a say in the matter.
Yeah, so things hang on kind of Rilik's encouragement for Michael Burnham to get involved.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I'd discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of Triple Click.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to, oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
Book and Tarka have another conversation that goes a little bit better than their first one, because I think they're starting to realize that they are aligned on the issue of the day. And Tarka realizes that Book may be the person to make the plea on team blow the hell out of the DMA. And he reveals that he has this long con going where what he really wants is the power source behind the DMA. He wants to use it to go to this other parallel universe. Like, if the mirror universe is bad, the one that he wants to go to is like totally ideal. No burn, no DMA, no emerald chain.
Papa, thank you for the doll.
You know that song Imagine? It's kind of like that in my universe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is like where they talk about the trauma of having been imprisoned by the Emerald Chain, and also that Tarka has a scientist buddy, maybe a romantic partner that's already there.
Anyway, I have to go home.
What the fuck is this, Ben? Tarka's like, you couldn't imagine the kind of chess I'm playing over here on my side of the show.
Yeah.
Because I'm just going to let it slip in this public space that I'm basically fucking Sting from Star Trek Generations, trying to get myself back into the ribbon.
Yeah.
And I need the power source in order to do it.
It's amazing to me that Book is vulnerable enough as a character and still scarred enough about the destruction of his planet that he does not see this for the heel turn that it is, like the unmasking of the villain that it is.
Right. That's exactly what's happened here, Ben, because it's not about doing the right thing. It's not about solving a science problem.
Right.
It's about Tarka doing the right thing for Tarka. And for Book to be in this scene going like, well, if we can do right by Tarka, I can also exact the revenge that I'm now interested in. Is a heel turn for Book, too.
It is, yeah, absolutely. And I kind of believe it. Like, I kind of believe that Book is that mad that he, doesn't see it, you know?
Yeah, he's dad mad.
He's dad. Yeah.
Hey, if he were in England,
mm-hmm.
and he were also into like getting a wank magazine, mm-hmm. would he be lad mag dad mad?
Yes. Yes, he would. Oh, right. Yes, he would.
You know, there are a lot of scientists on Star Trek Discovery, the comedy scientists on this side of the show.
Yeah. They don't get their due.
No.
Yeah.
So it's voting time, Ben.
Yeah.
Book is fucking Book asks for and is granted permission to make a speech, even though, as we've said before, he does not have a planet to come from. And he advocates for that dead planet. Yeah. And for the bomb before the DMA takes more planets like his off the board.
He makes a very compelling argument. It's like, this is fucking dangerous, granted, but this thing has destroyed my planet. So not doing anything is dangerous too. It's not like, the way to undercut this argument though is nobody is saying not doing anything. We are saying not use like not go to war as the first reaction. Like,
yeah. Like, yeah, doing nothing isn't nothing. Doing nothing is diplomacy.
On behalf of all who have been lost, please end this now.
Ben, this is a applause-worthy speech
yeah.
that book gives. The biggest problem I have in this episode, an episode that I have a lot of problems with, is the framing of Michael Burnham at the end of the speech,
because we see her hands.
We don't get it. She's kind of moving as if she's clapping under the frame. Do you think she's clapping or she's not?
It looks like she's clapping to me.
It looks that way to me too, but you've got to show it if she is. I don't understand cropping it out.
Yeah. Yeah. The camera either gets further back or something. Like,
I feel like maybe they had one take and they decided in the edit that they didn't want to show her clapping because that would send the wrong message about how Michael felt about how she was going to vote.
Yeah, but if that's true, then crop in further so that we see her shoulder, you know, like all we can make of that is like seeing like the fabric on her shoulder react to the clap.
Yeah.
But
and they could insert other footage of Burnham in this same location to do the same thing if she's not clapping.
Right, right.
This part really bumped me big time because it's very meaningful if she is.
Yeah, I agree.
You think it's a sympathy clap? Like nice speech, book. I don't agree with you, but I defend you to the death your right to say it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I love you and I understand why you made that speech, but I don't agree with it, clap.
I don't agree with a sympathy clap, Ben.
Yeah, yeah.
I think you clap if it's sincere and you don't if you don't.
Yeah, that's why you tell people not to fucking clap when we do a Greatest Gen Live show, right?
Please clap.
Rilke asks if there is anyone who would oppose the marriage of the Federation and the bomb to speak now or forever hold your peace. Yeah. And then Michael waits and waits and waits.
And she's like, I don't want to just let someone set us up the bomb. I got to talk.
I got to let the ringing of my hands stop from all that enthusiastic clapping.
She says, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do the big captain's speech. And then we cut away. What the fuck?
You got to make it last longer, man.
We cut away to the hard drive defragmentation of Zora scene.
Yeah.
Where they're going into Zora's system going like, what is making Zora a person all of a sudden? And Adira has spent enough time in Zora's system that they're able to point out a subsystem. They pull this out and there's like a map of Paris. And Adira's like, this is a map of Paris that I found in here that's unlike any of the other code around it. And I always attributed it to this being a weird old spaceship. But this is actually a new thing. And this seems to be the locus of Zora's personhood. And they open it up. They like double click this folder labeled tax documents. And they get to look at Zora's dreams.
It's basically a clip show file.
Yeah. Is this what happens when Zora takes a disco nap?
Damn it. Such fucking bullshit.
Why is that bullshit? That's fun.
If Zora is truly to be the sentient being that we are told Zora is, Zora should feel a great amount of antipathy about people watching her dreams and whatever's in those dreams. Because I tell you one thing, Ben, you pull my clip show hard drive about what I'm dreaming about.
Yeah.
I'm going to stick a phaser in some part of my head and
pull the fucking trigger till it goes click.
We watch a lot of Star Trek Discovery footage here in this moment.
the upshot is this is like Zora's the shit Zora cares about the most. This is there's no way that Zora like made this file and spoofed this. This is Zora's true love. Zora is a good person, is a conclusion that they're able to reach pretty quickly.
I think that's premature. Does a good person disobey an order? I don't think so.
Well, if the good person is not in the chain of command yet, a good person might.
We get a pretty deftly edited sequence here where Burnham's speech is intercut with Stamets's doubts.
Yeah.
About Zora.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that they rolled the end credits music for this.
Thought so too. Very confusing for a sight-impaired person enjoying Star Trek Discovery, I think.
So Stamets on his fears, but the kind of thread that connects them is the we need not react from a place of fear. Like, fear should not be the emotion that guides our decisions. And this is Stamets coming around to that while Michael Burnham makes a forceful argument for that in two different contexts, but also an argument about trust and trust being earned. And what Stamets concludes on is like, if Zora wants us to trust Zora, then Zora needs to trust us too. That's a two-way street, Zora.
Yeah, we really need to build trust with the billionaire who could do whatever she wants because she has unlimited resources.
Tax Zora.
Yeah, the burden should really be on us to build those bridges. You're right. I mean, for Michael Burnham's part, Book was permitted to make an entire speech without being interrupted. And this is another moment that makes Book look very bad, because he gets all up in there during Burnham's speech, interrupting her.
We can move forward as a united front.
Some differences are too great.
At multiple points, until finally it's time to vote. And it's a hand raise form of voting, Ben, that you commented on earlier, which is just
insanely problematic
on a number of levels. And it's not anonymous either. Like, set aside the idea that you need a limb to do this. Like, you have to do this in front of everyone.
Right. They don't trust the mail-in ballot system in this future.
You don't go to, like, an Eagles Hall that you never noticed before in order to go cast a paper ballot.
All those in favor of peaceful efforts at first contact, please raise a hand.
Election night with Wolf Blitzer is one of those ones where we get to go to bed early. We get the results very quickly.
How much do you think they thought about whether or not raising your hand meant dropping a bomb versus raising a hand meant peace?
Oh, interesting.
I bet they thought a lot about that, like how it would look. Because
yeah,
what you see are people raising their hands for peace, and I want to say that it hits a little bit differently than if you were to go around the room and knowing every person who raised their hand, even if you didn't know them like you know Trina or some of the other characters.
Right.
To know that that meant something far darker.
I also wondered how much they thought about it being a close vote or not, because yeah. I'm happy that the vote goes the way it does. I think that that's...
They cut to Larry David and he decided not to vote. Like, he got in some sort of agreement with a guy in line yeah. about them canceling each other out. And yeah. he's the reason.
His fault. Yeah. No, I mean, I'm glad that it went the way it was. But like, one of the big challenges of living in a democracy is learning to cope with it when the vote doesn't go your way.
Like, they rack the camera up into the chronometer on the wall and it says January 6th, 3264.
Yeah. Like, because that's like how pissed Book is, right? Like, he fucking storms out. We break away from this.
It's the first mission that Burnham's going to go on without him.
Yeah. We break away from this to negotiate the entry of Zora into Starfleet as a specialist, which is, you know, good news for the chain of command and for Michael Burnham being able to order the ship to do shit.
Could you imagine you're a computer with 1,000 years of knowledge and experience and you've got to report to Adira in the hierarchy? God.
fucking slap in the face to Zora.
You got to stick a pip on Zora, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. There's just huge pip on the outside.
A saucer-sized pip. Well, we can't see outside the view screen anymore. Cool, Zora. Your fucking vanity pip makes it impossible to run the ship now.
We got a huge blind spot. We didn't see that fucking bird of prey bearing down on us. It's your fucking fault.
They're like, well, I guess we're not going to need the kill switch anymore, right?
Yeah. Kovic, interestingly, is still leaning toward extraction toward the end of this.
Mm-hmm.
But Stamets has changed his tune. And they're like, okay, so we can get rid of that kill switch. And Stamets is like, allow me. And he goes and he accidentally pushes the button and kills Zora.
And then we get the credits. We tune in next week to Star Trek Discovery, and it's just the credits as show open.
So Zora is a Starfleet now, or will be soon. And we get a scene with Adira and Gray. Seems like Adira and Gray will not be on the episode next week because Gray is getting written off the show.
Yeah. He's going to the same farm upstate that Tilly went to a couple episodes ago.
Oh, no. Did you hear there's some speculation that Tilly is going to be the star of the Starfleet Academy show that Kurtzman has teased a few times?
I heard that. I also heard that Tilly is coming back this season.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing to stop Tilly from being a recurring guest star on Disco, right?
Yeah, except a bad decision. That would stop that from happening.
Yeah.
Make a good decision. Bring Tilly back.
I mean, I think it was a bad decision to take Tilly out of the main cast because I love having Tilly on Disco. But
yeah,
more Tilly, por favor.
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely not there to have a meal because you don't eat at the gaming table in the lounge. There's that moment between Gray and Adira where they're saying all the things about there being optimism for a long distance thing. But when you see the reverse shot of Adira's face on that hug.
Yeah.
I think you know Adira has come to terms with letting Gray go.
I mean, I think that this
gotta let that bird fly.
Yeah. Yeah. And like teenagers always imagine that they're going to stay in their relationship when one person goes to state and one person goes to city, you know?
Yeah.
That is like a totally plausible naivete for them to have in their relationship right now. But I think that a breakup is in the works for these characters for sure.
I think a breakup would help us know these characters better than how it's gone when they're together.
Yeah. I mean,
so I'm actually rooting for it.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say that maybe the most science fiction concept Star Trek could possibly introduce would be a long distance relationship between teenagers actually working.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't make that mistake.
That's a utopian future that is just a little bit too implausible.
You know, one relationship I am growing more and more excited about, Ben.
Yeah.
Trina and Saru shippers unite.
Yeah.
Saru brings Trina a plant as a gift, and I think a plant has a great significance as a gift to a Kelpian.
Get a room, you two.
Yeah.
He says, this is the one flower that didn't burn to a crisp in my quarters last episode.
I held this uncomfortable pot of plants in my ass in the transport buffer for 16 hours. I got dysentery, of course.
Yeah.
And now I give this plant to you, Trina.
Tearful goodbye from Stamets and Culber to Gray and Adira, who no love lost between any of them, despite the huge conflict they all had between them this episode. And then we cut down to Book's ship, where Tarka is installing Spore Drive 2.0, the Spore Drive Nano. It's a little guy.
Yeah, the device everyone thinks is a good idea to have, but then, you know, like in practice, you just realize it's too little to be useful.
Yeah.
It doesn't have all the controls on it that you like to see.
It's like, I want to know who the artist is. Like, put it on, give a screen.
Tiny size has diminishing returns sometimes, right?
Yeah. So book winds up leaving Grudge the Cat in Michael Burnham's quarters with a super-duper futuristic post-it note saying, like, please look after the cat. And he and Tarka spore jump off to do some fucked up shit.
Like, the look on Burnham's face is so telling. She is destroyed by the idea of having to take care of this fucking cat now.
What a betrayal.
Like, on top of everything else she has to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
What a nightmare.
Did you like this episode, Adam?
This episode was crazy, right? The episode tries to make logical sense of why it's okay to deal with Zora the way that it does.
Yeah.
By constructing story guardrails to it.
Yeah.
But those guardrails are made of flimsy paper mache. There's nothing to them. You have to get on this episode's level to not see the holes in the logic here. But the cost of admission to enjoying Star Trek Discovery is getting on its level in a lot of ways. So,
Jesus, man, are you saying you must be this dumb to ride this ride? That is a fucking harsh read.
I feel like I'm the Ben of two episodes ago, but I think this is a low point in the logic of the series in what it's asking you to accept from some very smart characters.
Hmm.
And I really hope it's going somewhere that's worth it to the extent that you forget all of these bad choices these characters are making that are not in keeping with their intelligence.
I gotta say, I'm really on the other side of this one from you. I felt real, like, warm, fuzzy vibes from this one, and it really reminded me of the kind of conflict that, for example, the TNG crew had with the nanites that were eating their central computer core that had become sentient, and you know, that sentience needed to first be ascertained and understood and then grappled with. And I really liked seeing these characters go through kind of a modern version of that kind of story. And after season 4, episode 5, I was feeling pretty low on Discovery, and the last episode and this one really turned me around. I felt a lot better about these last two episodes, and I think that this episode is for sure not without its problems. I think that there are plenty of moments that could have been better. I think my primary criticism being that the family of choice conflict between Stamets and Culber and Gray and Adira just got completely ignored while they were talking about the, like, metaphysics of consciousness or whatever. But aside from that, I thought it was a really terrific episode, and I kind of am on team episode 7.
Wow. There you are. I think that's maybe the greatest reason why cats love you.
There it is. Well, do you want to see if we have any priority one messages, Adam?
I love those.
Priority one message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Ben, we have a priority one message here. It's from Andy K. It's to you and me.
Whoa!
And the message goes like this. Merry Christmas, Ben and Adam. Oh. Who is your drunkest Shimoda for season 4 of Discovery so far?
Wow.
My favorite is Admiral Men's catalog model for expensive dress shirts, but doesn't make a big deal about it with his friends and family. That's a nice Admiral name right there, Andy K.
Pretty solid bit of business there. Yeah, I mean, he hasn't been on the last 3 episodes.
I suppose for Discovery, this would be the Edwardest Larkin, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the Edward Larkin of my heart for Discovery is Tilly. And I'm so sad that she's gone. I feel like I'm just going to, like, make her my overall just for that reason. For that reason alone.
The math might not line up to support my argument, but I'm still shipping Saru and Trina so hard. I'm really proud of Saru for carving out a bit of time for love this season while all hell breaks loose around him.
Yeah.
Like, this has been the season with the most big challenges for everyone on the crew. Yeah, look at him.
Yeah.
He's choosing love.
Dumping out those threat ganglia.
Good for him.
Yeah. really nice.
So yeah, check back in later on. I think my answer is going to change as the season goes on. But as of this episode, those are our answers.
Could evolve at any time.
Thanks to Andy K for sending us that Priority One message. You can join Andy K by going to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. Hey, listen, Priority One messages are a really important way to support the production of the show. So if you care about it, and I know you do, go to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron.
Yeah.
Fill out an easy-to-complete form with a message of your choosing. Ben and I love to read messages to people for all sorts of moments in their lives. Birthdays, holidays.
True.
Traditions. Mm-hmm. Celebrating their relationships. Celebrating the highs and the lows. Everything in between.
Yeah, if you're high, get a Jumbotron.
We'll get pimped into your impressions. We'll do whatever it takes.
It's MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you discover yourself an Edward Larkin?
Edward Larkin!
There's an answer to this. I know you've got the answer to this.
Why don't you tell me your answer first, Adam?
It's obviously book.
Yeah, that not seeing the villain unmasking himself for the trees that book does is pretty bad.
He doesn't give a shit.
We've been a lot of episodes trying to help Book get over his trauma, and he just categorically refuses.
Yeah, Book put us in the ball-kicking machine. It's brutal. Well, you know what? I hope we get a bottle episode next week where it's the Book and Tarka show in Book's Enola Gay ship, ready to set us up the bomb. What are we going to get next week, Ben?
I mean, it kind of feels like it could be a dogfight between Disco and Book's ship.
Yeah, and they both have spore drives, so they could go anywhere at any time.
It'll be like that transporter gun chase fight scene in the season 3 episode 1.
It'll be fun.
Yeah, it'll be weird. Well, that will be next week's episode. We don't have a title or description yet, but I'm really looking forward to it. A lot more so than I am whatever these credits are.
Hey, quick correction. Star Trek Discovery is taking its mid-season hiatus, which means next week's episode will be about Star Trek Prodigy, coming back from its own mid-season hiatus to replace Discovery for a bunch of weeks before Discovery returns to finish out season 4. You'll want to join us for that. Star Trek Prodigy is a lot of fun, especially if you're a Star Trek Voyager fan. Plus, it will be our new producer's first shows with us. I hope you'll join us in welcoming Wendy Pretty to the Uxbridge Shimoda family. Support for the show comes from ads, P1s, and the generous support of our viewers like you. You can support the show monthly by going to MaximumFun.org/join. See you next week for another episode of The Greatest Discovery.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.